The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books Podcast.
Murr Ball is the host of the podcast A Lost Cause out of Sweden. He is also a former social worker turned barista, an immigrant, and a socialist. He joins the Zero Books podcast in order to discuss immigration to the Swedish utopia and why the Scandinavian model really is a worker's paradise. Or maybe that's not the conclusion we reached. It's Wednesday, October 10th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you haven't already supported us on Patreon, you're missing out on a second podcast every week. And if you haven't joined the Zero Books reading group, then you're missing out on a chance to discuss Adorno. We're edging up towards 500 patrons, so now is a good time to join. The music you're listening to right now is Franz Berwald's A Symphony in E-flat, or a finale from the Symphony in E-flat. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to a discussion about the Swedish utopia. Murr Ball is a former social worker, born and raised in Sweden. He has been engaging different left projects and groups in Sweden since he was 14. He is the host of the Swedish podcast Lost Cause, and this week we're going to discuss immigration in Sweden and in general. That is what I've got for you, but you sent me a longer bio, Murr, so why don't you fill it in and let people know who you are and what your story is a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Basically, I come from an immigrant background in Sweden, in one of the three major cities, and I grew up in Gothenburg, and had my formative years during the 90s, where the neighborhood I grew up in were the most ravaged by gang violence in Sweden during that time. When I was around, well, say between 12 and 15, just the street that I was living on were the nexus of the gang violence with the three major gangs, basically shooting up each other. It was around, I believe, 8 death shootings on my streets, a lot of drive-bys, a lot of bombings of small shops who didn't pay their rent to the, and I put rent there in quote marks for protection, basically. So it was one of the more troubled immigrant neighborhoods in Sweden. It isn't today because of gentrification. But I grew up with that experience in the working class. My father was an industry worker who was laid off after the financial crisis and a political refugee. My mother was on sick leave basically during the whole time I was growing up. So I basically began working when I was 14 years old to support the family.
Okay, and so your father was a political refugee. Where was he a refugee? Where were you from? Where was your family from again?
My father is a political refugee from Kurdistan. He was a draft dodger in Turkey and joined the Kurdish, one of the many Kurdish militias, who was basically doing self-defense against the genocide, against the Kurds. He hasn't he has never been very political. That was just a cultural thing. You don't want to see your family get butchered by the Turkish military, so you basically raise arms in self-defense. The political side I have gotten from my mother, who comes from a line of this old-fashioned Swedish social democrats, and she got radicalized during the Thatcher years.
And you started working when you were 14. What industry did you start working in?
I basically began working as a cleaner at Volvo, which then was one of the major industries in Sweden. And I worked at cafes. I worked in cleaning. I worked at making cars. Then I tried to get out of the trap for basically working class people by going to university directly, and became a social worker, which I worked with for perhaps 7 years until I quit this year, actually. And, because of several reasons of dysfunctioning in the welfare state, the average time for a social worker to stay in the field in Sweden is 3 years. And then basically you go to work at McDonald's or the local store because the working conditions is so much better.
So people don't get promoted out of that position into politics or into some other profession?
I mean, you can make a career in the civil service, yeah. But the civil service in Sweden is dysfunctional. When I hear you guys in the USA talking about that we need universal health care and that we have to go for the Scandinavian model, I just bash my head against the wall like, yeah, it's better than what you have, but it isn't working. It isn't working at all.
Okay. Well, so let's talk about that for a minute. Let's just stop right here and talk about that, because that's for my listeners, and I think for Americans, it's really important to hear your perspective. Well, the first thing I want to ask you is, how is it that you had to work at the age of 14 if you are living in a social democratic, you know, Sweden, where there's supposed to be plenty of a big safety net for everyone, and just the way we imagine it in the United States is that poverty is practically eliminated, and that we've got the most you must have the most empowered working class of any nation, and all of that kind of thing. So So tell me the truth instead of what my idle daydream is.
Yeah, exactly. Well, basically, I grew up during the 90s, and we had our biggest financial crash during the 90s, where basically the welfare state was eroded. Yeah, when I say that the welfare state is eroded, yeah, we still have free daycare for children. We still have free, somewhat free, healthcare, even if, yeah, it isn't as dysfunctional as in the US, but most other social democratic countries have, in some respects, more functioning healthcare systems. Education is totally free, and you don't have to go into the streets with the social security net. But that doesn't mean that if you, as I did, grew up with a single mom, like, it doesn't cover it. I believe most of my classmates, well, I had the good fortune of being able to get real jobs in the white sector. Most of them were selling drugs because, like, the social security net doesn't add up to rent, to food. We have seen a staggering rate in the increase of child poverty in Sweden. And that basically means that there are a lot of parents who, yeah, they can afford rent, but then they have to skip eating 2 or 3 times a week so that the children can eat. That shit still happens here, and it's a growing problem.
how is this, is poverty racialized in Sweden?
Oh, very much. I have worked all across the country as a social worker. I have worked in the Swedish comparison to the Rust Belt, with the white working class and their children, and with immigrants. And what I can say is that, well, people don't stop. People don't die of poverty in Sweden. People are just living a living hell and have to turn every dime to go around. It is racialized in the way, and here comes a peculiarity of Swedish racial politics. Up until like basically the 80s, we were pretty homogenized country racially. Like I believe only 5% were of non-Swedish origins or non-Finnish origins, which is our neighboring country, which we had as a colony basically up until the 18th century. But then we had a big influx of refugees, mainly from Latin America, because we had a strong radical Swedish prime minister named Olof Palme, who was assassinated during the 80s, and he basically opened the borders for political refugees from Latin America during that time when you planned all the coups there.
Well, it wasn't me, but it was my government.
well, you are the token American right now.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
And after that, during that time, we thought that, oh, it's a great problem that they aren't getting integrated, but it was working functionally well. Before that, we had some, during the 70s, we had a lot of, no, 50s, we had a lot of Italians and Finnish people who came to work in our industries. But then I would say the real problem with immigration in Sweden began during the 90s. And that was with when Yugoslavia fell apart. So basically we had a big influx of immigrants from Pakistan, from former Yugoslavia, primarily. And the people from former Yugoslavia came to Sweden during a time when our economy was in shambles. The industry was fleeing the country. During some week, our interest rate were up like 500%. The 90s were worse than the 2008 crash.
For Sweden.
And it wasn't bettered by the fact that for the first time in like 30 years, we had a right-wing government who fucked everything up.
How did the radical left in Sweden interpret and respond to the economic crisis? And I'm going to add a little something to it. My understanding is that in the 70s, and this is when I was just a little kid, the economic crisis in the United States turned the radical left in the United States back to Marx, although maybe not very effectively or to little effect politically. But there was a turn back to Marx on the left for a while in the 70s. And I'm just wondering if the Swedish left embraced Marx at that time or...
Yeah, absolutely. Like during the 70s and 60s, during the 90s... well, no. Because we had like basically 10 years of neoliberalism before that. So what the Swedish left did was primarily return to Keynesianism and the old Swedish social democratic redistributional politics and the fight against privatizations. It shall be added that the left in Sweden is a very peculiar beast. If we compare it to the US, where you have a two-party system, in Sweden we have a multi-party system. So right now we have 8 parties in the parliament. And during the 90s and before that, we had like 5 or 6, depending on which time you look at. And the Social Democrats were the hegemonic force on the left. And then we had the big Communist Party who changed their name to the Left Party during the 90s and early 2000s. But they were basically the Comintern's party. And as most people would know, the Comintern parties were never able to adapt to national peculiarities, because they basically took their orders from the Soviet Union. And the Social Democrats in Sweden were a genuine workers' movement. Unlike, say, Germany or France, where the vast majority were workers, but the educational structures of the German Social Democrats were built by intellectuals who were schooling the workers. In Sweden, the workers basically schooled themselves. They started up own circles and learned everything from scratch. And that led to a very strong emphasis on discipline and on a hierarchical party. And a very strong faith in the party leadership.
It was an autodidactic process, organic, that led to a very strong hierarchical structure and reliance on party leaders.
Yeah, and that's quite... It makes sense if you think about it, because if the Swedish worker movement was built during the turn of the last centuries, so you had basically workers who, well, they could read, but not functionally read. And they were trying to get the right to vote, to unionize. And they basically had to learn to occupy space in the political sphere. As a worker, you worked 12 hours a day and you tried to learn the basics about socialism, and you had a socialist party.
So you're talking about the 19th to the 20th century.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. I got confused because I thought for a moment we were talking about the 20th to the 21st.
Oh,
no.
Sorry.
Yeah. That's okay.
And if you are in that predicament as a worker, you soon realize that you cannot, in your condition, learn everything you need to learn on your own. And you can't even build the theoretical grasp of understanding everything. So you delegate things upwards and upwards. And you don't have intellectuals on the ground who can sample that process. I would say that the fact that in Germany, for example, you had a such broad strata of the petty bourgeoisie, the intelligentsia, teachers, professors who joined the Social Democratic Party, made an influx of critical and anti-hierarchical thinking that then was carried on by the workers. In Sweden, which was a much more brutal class society, the intelligentsia never joined the Social Democrats until like the 50s. So they had to rely on their own organizations when they were being persecuted. And when you have to rely on your own organizations, you have to be able to trust your leaders. And then you build a cadre and an organization which is built upon trusting your leaders.
Was there to kind of turn this back to the topic of immigration? Was there a nationalist or ethnic component to the left around that time? And was it difficult to? I mean, the labor movement in general in the United States has kind of got a reputation of not taking on identity issues, and by that, it you know not being very quick to integrate and fight for, say, black workers in the United States or immigrant workers, and also slow to take on board the movements from women and gays and other groups. You know, I kind of tend to think that is somewhat overstated, but it's not completely wrong. So I'm just wondering how woke the Swedish left was or is today.
I mean,
today.
The Swedish left is woke. I mean, the Social Democrat is the party in power, so they have always been quite restrictive on immigration issues. But I wouldn't say that they have for a long time dabbled in anti-immigrant sentiments, at least not since the 60s. Then you have to know Sweden was the country that invented racial science. We were the first country in the world who invented racial science. The concept of racial science was coined in Sweden by one of our former biologists who is still on our 20 kronor bill, Carl von Linné. And we had the eugenics program in Sweden up until like the 80s as well. Yeah, like as a social worker, I have still like met women who were like castrated because they were a little bit too fond of girls and boys. Yeah. Yeah, like, we have some dark shit in our history. The Social Democrats often get blamed for that, and they shall take a part of the blame. But the more I read about it, the more I realize that it was the right wing who was pushing it all along, and they had their professional classes on their side. And the professional classes are doctors, are psychiatrists, are social workers. The Swedish Social Democrats have always had a very strong trust of institutions. After they believed that they had taken over the state, like, say, during the 30s or 40s, when the Swedish Social Democrats and the state become basically synonymous, they trusted those guys far too much, basically. And we have a history of brutal repression against our own natives, the Sami. I don't know what the word is in English, actually. But basically, we took away their children up until the 70s. We still refuse to give them back skeletons from graves we have plundered, like, during the 90s now. So... And Sweden is an homogenous country and still sees itself as it. And because we have seen it ourselves as an ethnical homogenous country and also seen ourselves as the good guys, because we have been the proper social democrats who thought of apartheid, Olof Palme went out and our former prime minister was assassinated, condemned the USA during the Second World War and called Nixon fucking killer in national television.
You mean during the Vietnam War?
Yeah.
You condemned the USA, not during the Second World War.
Then as well.
Oh, really?
Yeah, condemned the bombing of Dresden.
Oh, okay.
As barbarous slaughter of innocents.
Well, I mean, you know, if you're going to nitpick.
Yeah.
But anyhow... I mean, we were saving the world and all from the Nazis, but
true story.
Attention, please. You're having a visitor. Howard Campbell, Jr.
I've just come back from the Russian front, so I'll make it short. I don't want to take up your time. I know how hungry you are. Food's not much, though, is it?
Food's terrific. Almost as neat as your outfit.
Then I have a proposition for you. How would you like to come back to America with me after this war as heroes?
It's great, as long as I could wear that fag outfit.
Since you're so interested in my outfit, I'll tell you what it's about. Blue is for the American sky. White is for the race that pioneered that continent, cleared the forests, drained the swamps, built the roads and the bridges. And the red is for the blood of fine American boys that's been shed in defense of your freedom.
I don't see you shedding any blood, Campbell.
You all know that communism is out to enslave the world. And who's out there trying to stop them? The Germans. They're not your enemies. They're your allies. Communism is the enemy of all of us. Now, I want volunteers for the Free American Corps. Men who are willing to stand up to these commies.
Sit down, Lozano. I didn't vote for you, Derby.
Good. Now, who's next? I'll tell you, men, if we don't stop them now, they're going
to... Everybody moves to the air shelter.
There be no bombs. Churchill's nebula's right in the heart of it.
So what I want to get at is just your experience as a child of immigrants in Sweden, and also, I guess, more than hearing stories, I want to hear your ideas about how to understand immigration overall within capitalism or to the first world, you know, first world immigrants and what their experience is and what the way the issue gets framed. And what we might do to help struggle against the oppression of immigrants and the exploitation of immigrants without handing too much to the right. Because it seems to me that the way we turn immigrants into, I'm going to say dolphins, in other words, complete innocents who only need to be protected rather than dealt with as political actors. We lose again and again when it comes to winning the hearts and mind of native populations, whether it's in Sweden or in the United States or wherever, especially working class or petite bourgeois natives.
Yeah, absolutely. And if there was a silver bullet there, I would have given it to you. But I really believe that you have to go into the particularities of that country that you are looking at, and like basically the institutional history. Because yeah, racism and white nationalism is a thing. I had to change my name to get a job many times. Now I've changed it back. I have been beaten up by Nazis more than once. But you cannot blame the situation of immigrants on racism alone, because racism is always mediated through state structures and often not even consciously. So, like, a good example for your US listeners would be the mass incarceration problem and the draconian measures that was put in the war against drugs in the US, which was supported by most civil rights front figures in the US during the 90s.
Right. Most black politicians, anyway, were very supportive of punitive policies.
And most of the inhabitants of those neighborhoods as well, actually.
Right.
And like, as someone who grew up in such a neighborhood, I can understand why. Like, you don't want to see the daycare centers where your child are at the day being used as like, seeing drug dealers selling heroin outside it. It's it makes you uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Of course it does. But that leads to mass incarceration, which leads to, and so.
But you would think, okay, but in Sweden, I would think that there are, there, that what happened in the United States with the, these punitive measures were basically the only solution for these kind of social problems was the police in prisons. I would think that that wouldn't be obtained in Sweden, that in Sweden there would have been other kinds of policies to deal with these sorts of issues other than just the police and the, for instance, social work.
Social work has been a part of it. Mostly in Sweden, we have tried to go through the schools. But the problem is that when the immigration problem became a real problem during the 90s, the neoliberal the neoliberalization of institutions were in full run. During the 90s, we got charter schools, which you only are getting now in the US, as far as I can understand it.
Yeah, recently.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And our charter schools are much more brutalized and much less regulated than any you have in the USA. Like, only Chile has more deregulated charter schools. Yeah, only Chile. And that is a lot from Pinochet.
Jesus. Yeah. So that's not what you would expect in the shining beacon on the hill that is Sweden. And the, so why is this happening? Is it just an economic, is it just economic pressures that are?
I mean, basically a bit of social history during the 60s and 70s. The workers' movements in Sweden were getting really radicalized. Partially due to economic reasons. The economy was going really well. And that radicalized people. Because then you didn't have to stay at the same job if you, were not satisfied with how your boss treated you. You could go and get a job at another factory. And so there were a lot of wildcat strikes, primarily Trotskyists and some Stalinists and Maoists as well, were really going in to the workers, to the factories and working and building unions, which were really successful. And all of this radicalized the Social Democrats as well. And the Social Democrats had made a compromise with the capitalists basically during the 30s that, like, okay, we will expand the welfare state and tax you as hell, but we won't take stuff from you. We won't nationalize the industry and you will leave us alone. And the radicalization of the workers' movement led to a schema proposed by the Social Democrats and the unions, who... I don't know if the word is translated into English yet, but it was basically a pension scheme where some part of each company's earnings were supposed, like 1% of the profits or 5% of the profits of every company were supposed to be put in a pension fund. Who then owned a part of the companies. So basically it was gradual socialization via the unions who owned the pension scheme. So basically in 50 years, the unions would own everything.
Wow. Okay.
And the Social Democrat put this into law. It were in fact from like 82 to 94. And and the right went haywire.
Right. Yeah. Well, of course.
Yeah. And they broke off the truce with the Social Democrats.
Right.
And they put in one of the most brutal neoliberal offensives with propaganda that we have ever seen, who basically led to our prime minister who put this in place, Olof Palme, being assassinated. He was assassinated in 86. They still don't know who did it. And that's a whole nother story. But basically the old right, which in Sweden is basically old Nazis and feudal lords, and big capital made an alliance where they like took, I have seen, numbers on this, like 2% of the total GDP of Sweden and put it into think tanks and propaganda. Yeah, it was a massive offensive. And with a succession of a small economical crisis, which Sweden probably could have managed in a social democratic way, I think, that massive offensive, which was very much concerted towards the professional classes, which by then had become an important factor in the internal politics of the Social Democrats, basically turned the Social Democrats into Blairites during the 80s. With the only exception for our Prime Minister, who later was assassinated. Yeah. and that scheme, like, so the... Basically, what happened was that the Social Democrats became enacted pension reform, deregulations that Margaret Thatcher said she would never have dared to try in Great Britain. And Reagan said he admired.
The consequence of all that today is that you have a pretty strong right wing in Sweden, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the right wing is And not just like conservative right wing, but there's also a building radical right in Sweden.
I mean, the radical right never really went away. Most Swedish people even don't know this. But the more I do some digging, like our greatest right wing party, which is called the Moderates, the former right party, were founded like after the Social Democrats as the main opposition party towards socialism. Like, they were basically Nazis for a very long time. The current immigration problems in Sweden would be possible to fix. We can go in what happened with the great refugee wave later. That would be interesting because I worked at the field with single coming refugee children during 2015 and 16 when what is now coined the system collapse happened in Sweden. Basically, we got 100,000 and 200,000 refugees during 1 year from primarily Syria and Afghanistan. Which put a lot of strain on our social system. But I believe we could have managed that if it weren't for the fact that for two reasons. Basically, we have seen cuts and cuts and cuts since the 80s on social services, where we still have all the rights on paper, but they are exceedingly hard to get in reality. And we are seeing a massive bureaucratization of all social services and all of the public's response. Where the bureaucracy has gotten its own life. So a social worker and a teacher like spends most of their day doing paperwork.
Rather than teaching or helping someone.
And that's the same thing in the US. I believe in Sweden, it is a teacher do like 50% teaching, 50% administration. So 50-50. But the social worker, say you as a social worker work between 8 and 10 hours a day. Perhaps when I worked as a social worker, it was perhaps 15 minutes, 30 minutes social work. The rest was feeding this gigantic, barbarian nightmare of a bureaucratic system, which is growing and growing, much due to neoliberalism. Because neoliberalism is basically about making the public institution run as a private company. As a private company, you need to have certain formula, you have to treat them as a customer, you have to outsource basically everything, so you are not allowed to do anything in-house, then you have to buy services from other people, and all this has to go to court and have the proper papers and formulas, so there is no time left for social work. And we have seen, so during the 90s, when the first refugee wave hit, who we weren't really able to handle, we saw a great strain on public, even before that, we saw a great strain on public resources. There wasn't enough money because of more and more cuts. And we saw a bureaucracy who had an interest in growing itself. Because
whenever I'm talking about the left in Sweden, I'm talking about a left that has some political power, right? That's important.
Yes and no. Yes and no. I would say that there is much more of a left in the U.S. today than there are in Sweden.
Okay.
Yeah, because the Social Democrats are basically the Blairites. Like...
Okay, still.
Yeah, still. They haven't left that. And they are crashing down on any opposition much more effective than Clinton ever did.
Do you have a countercultural left in Sweden? You know,
we have the social justice warriors, as you call them in Sweden. And they are basically Clinton liberals. They would never admit that they are. They claim to be socialists, but if you look at their economic policies and so on and so forth, they aren't. Like,
yeah, but I mean, like, what, do you have journals that are supposedly part of the far left or like,
But those are like small sects, like who have, I mean, we have the Communist Party of Sweden, which broke with the Comintern in like the 60s because they weren't pro-Stalin enough. They have like 300 or 400 members. We have some small Trotskyite groups. We have like 100 members each. So like we have those small, really small, sects, basically 3 or 4 of them. And perhaps together they make up like 500 people.
So in Sweden, it's not the case then that the kind of Nazi right is in any way intersecting with the left.
No. I mean, there have been a couple of notable intellectuals who have left from the far left to the far right, like 2 or 3, but not in the movement. No. I would like to turn that back to the question of bureaucracy, because the reason why I believe the far right is so much on the rise in Sweden is that racism, of course, because we are seeing a vast demographic shift in Sweden right now. And it is really hard to get good statistics on this because we are not allowed to make racial statistics in Sweden by law.
Oh.
Yeah, because that will lead to Nazism or something.
Okay.
Yeah, but like we have 17.9% of our citizens who are foreign born.
Mm-hmm.
And if you count children who are born in households where both parents are immigrants, you have 23%. And that does not count. I does not count as an immigrant in that fact because I have a Swedish mother.
Right.
And you cannot, like, if you pull people like me into that statistic, you would probably get up to 30 or 40%. And go back to the 60s and 70s, max 10%. Probably more around 5%. So, right. So we have seen a massive demographic shift on the same time that as all around the world, workplaces have become more brutalized, wages have not risen, we have seen massive increases in cost of living, economic inequality has been more on the rise in Sweden than in any other developed country, mostly because we have had a such good standing before, but that relative fall is still a huge relative fall. And on the same time, you see a middle class who before had like quite alienated jobs. You were a teacher, you were a social worker, you were a nurse, you were a doctor. Sure, you didn't get much pay, but you had a meaningful job. And today you push around papers and basically get burned out after 2 years.
Yeah, like you did. Like you took seven, but
yeah. And like that is more than the double amount of years that most social workers manage. And like, to be clear, I went down from basically say $4,000 a month, which is a good salary in Sweden, really good, to $1,000 a month. And I did that because I worked 12 hours a day and couldn't sleep. And many teachers are doing the same thing. Like, you are choosing to live on the poverty line rather than keep working in the public sector because the working condition sucks. And that combination with a bigger alienation within the middle class, a working class who is feeling much more pressed, a Blairite, Clintonite elite of social democrats who are talking about other things, and dysfunctional and a dysfunctional welfare state who is eaten up by bureaucracy at the same time as massive demographic shift makes that a demographic shift is being conflated in the head of.
It's a correlation, but not a causation, exactly. But it's just the scapegoat is this demographic shift. And, you know, in the United States, I don't know if the demographic shift has been nearly as dramatic. I don't think it has in the United States.
But
it's talked about a lot.
Yeah.
It's talked about a lot within 30 years, the white population in the United States will no longer be the majority population.
Yeah.
Of course, there won't be another ethnic group that will be the majority population. It'll just be, less than half of the population overall will be white, and then it'll be a whole bunch of different kinds of people who will be everything else, yeah. Right? It's not like, but in any case, this is being made a big deal of, and it's being made a big deal of on both the right and the left.
Yeah.
I mean, like the left will talk about how this is going to be great. It will mean the end of the Republican Party. It will end white supremacy.
Oh, yeah, because that works so well in Lebanon.
Right. I mean, it just
there isn't a single case in the world where massive demographic shifts have led to civil unrest. Certainly when you see that all the public services and the living standard of common people are being more and more squeezed.
Right. I mean, I have no problem with the demographic shift in and of itself. Right. But if you hold on to the significance of ethnicity at the same time, then I've got a problem because you're suddenly saying, oh yeah, well, every other population is a social democrat by nature. It's only white people who are conservative by nature.
Which is blankly false. Of course it is.
Right.
In Sweden, I am very pessimistic about the future, really. Many of my friends who are immigrants are looking to move abroad after this coming election out of fear. Because our far-right party called the Swedish Democrats, they were created during the 90s, basically as an offshoot of a real Nazi party with skinheads. Like the Swedish Democrats during like 94, I think, they had to put in their bylaws that you were not allowed to wear SS uniforms in public. Yeah.
And they're likely to win this next election?
We have a parliamentary democracy, so you don't win outright. But they are likely to get like between 20% and 30% of the votes.
It wasn't quite the result they'd hoped for, but the Sweden Democrats stole significant ground in this election, and its supporters were keen to advertise their success. Cheering the man who drove the narrative of recent weeks and persuaded so many Swedish voters to switch their allegiance. And Jimmy Åkesson feels emboldened. The Sweden Democrats, he insisted, are the fresh force in politics.
Do you know what, friends of Sweden? They said on the TV that it's hard to declare a winner of this election. I know who has won this election. It's the Sweden Democrats.
He wants to talk to the main political leaders in Sweden, who have so far shunned cooperation with his hardline anti-immigrant movement. But many voters didn't, propelling the party into promising territory.
His party has certainly shaken up politics here, and the big question now is whether the Sweden Democrats can do kingmakers, whether any of the main parties will be willing to get into bed with them, and whether they will say yes.
Supporters sense the opportunity, warning of a backlash if the party's success is ignored.
I think if they don't speak with us, they're going to have big problems in the future, and Swedish Democrats is just going to continue growing.
This is the people. We're the party of the people. This is 2 or 3 million people in Sweden saying enough. We need a change.
And change is what this man is resisting. Prime Minister Stefan Löfven pushing back against calls to go after his party's worst results in a century, leaving his centre-left coalition neck and neck with the centre-right bloc. But he won't be looking to the Sweden Democrats for help, a party he has condemned as racist.
Of course, I'm disappointed by the fact that the party with Nazi roots could gain so much ground. They have no budget that will work, no improvements that will make life easier for people. The only thing they could offer is a widening gap in society and growing hatred.
The election results followed a European trend of traditional parties being shaken by the far right, and the centre-right alliance also suffered. The Sweden Democrats are hoping for a quick meeting with the leader of the bloc's biggest party, but he too has up to now rejected cooperation, which leaves Swedish politics in a state of turmoil. And this man hoping in time he will have a hand to play. Michelle Clifford, Sky News, Sweden.
Wow.
2 elections ago, this will be the 3rd election when they are in the parliament. Before that, they weren't even in the parliament. And they have pushed the conservative party, the moderates, to the right in extreme ways, who were basically, 6 years ago, they were moderate Republicans. Like, think of them as James Cameron in mm-hmm. Great Britain. Actually, David Cameron. Actually, David Cameron spoke quite openly about how his whole campaign and deal was about copy-pasting the Swedish moderates.
Mm-hmm.
And now they are basically like Donald Trump, but they are more well-dressed and don't swear.
Great, and that's the moderate, not the not the right.
Yeah, like the Swedish Democrats. Well, they have a really slick party leader, but the rank and file are speaking about, like, during the great influx of immigrants during 2015, quite a lot of them were speaking about putting up semi-automatic guns and shooting all the refugees so they wouldn't get in. I mean, the Swedish Democrats, when I was a child, Antifa patrolled the way to my daycare center so that the Swedish Democrats and their fellows wouldn't beat the shit out of immigrant kids.
Well, I'm glad that there was something like Antifa there to make sure you weren't beaten.
Yeah, and like well, this sounds, Antifa this... did really great job in Sweden during the 90s. Like,
right.
They patrolled immigrant homes. They saved a lot of lives because the police in Sweden have really long connections with the far right. Like, and then I am speaking about the European far right, like these yeah. old arch reactionaries who want to go back to the Weimar Republic.
There is some connection in the United States between, like the Klan and the police. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's quite as universal, here. But it's certainly there.
Sweden anymore. But like during the 90s and 80s, it was quite explicit. Like the police said that our prime minister should be shot. The police union. And oh, some weeks after they said that, he was assassinated. And the police never caught the offenders. And like 10 years later, they found a weird drug addict and said that he did it. But he then recanted his confession. It's all very, very murky.
Listen, you should come back onto the podcast again sooner rather than later, because I feel like we're just beginning to scratch the surface here, but we've been talking for just about an hour.
And like,
I've got to jump and do some other things, but look, it was really interesting. I feel very depressed. You haven't made things at all easy.
I would like to.
Go ahead.
Why I am so pessimistic about the things in Sweden is that we have a parliamentary democracy with a lot of different parties. In the US and in Great Britain, you have a two-party system, basically, which means that the left cannot be compliant with like getting 5 or 4% in the elections. So then it is only because that the left don't have their own party in Congress that they are able to mobilize the way they are in the US and in the UK right now, because you don't have that kind of pressure relief that the small parties who are staying on the fringes and don't really doing anything can create.
So you're saying that we end up mobilizing more because we are not kind of splintered into 1,000 different little pieces of our government.
Yeah, and like there are a lot of good social democrats here in Sweden. They are all purged from any sort of positions of power, of course, but they stay in the party. And then we have the formal left party, which is a joke, and they never get over 10%. And you have our Tumblr party, basically, Feminist Initiative, who are basically a caricature of the Tumblr left. and they made their own parliamentary party. They will never get into parliament, but they still get around 2% of the votes. And yeah. All these splinter groups are working as pressure reliefs for the left. But
people in the United States would complain, well, what happens in the U.S. is that the left gets redirected from any kind of revolutionary socialist project into supporting whatever the Democratic Party is deciding to do.
Well, but that simply ain't true. Like, look at the American politics now. Like, I am not optimistic about your shit either, but you had right now a socialist congresswoman in...
That's right. That's right.
And you are forced to mobilize with ruthless force against your own party, the Democrats. That's right.
There is a faction right now within the left. That's, I would say, the DSA is probably the biggest symptom of this, or symbol of this. But it isn't the only part of the left wing of the Democratic Party that's trying to move the Democrats and even oppose the Democrats.
Yeah. And the same thing in Great Britain with Corbynism.
Right. That's right.
The multi-party system makes that impossible, I would say.